This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled to be joined today by Lexi Kaiser. Lexi is one of our brilliant journalists who joins us regularly in the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. She joins us to talk about what stories she's watching closely. Lexi, let me tee it up and ask you to take it away. What are a couple of the stories that you're following closely currently?
Sure thing. Thank you so much for having me, Scott. So this week, I've spoken with a lot of chief human resources officers and chief people officers at health systems across the country about a couple of issues that we've been tracking on our HR and talent desk at Becker's Hospital Review. So the first one, I actually have a question for you. How much time do you estimate that you spend in meetings per week?
You know, it's a great question. Not as many as I used to. And it depends what you define as a meeting. A meeting could be, I don't consider sort of a podcast like this, a meeting.
Right.
I spent Monday, Tuesday in relatively lengthy meetings for one business effort. And then, you know, throughout the week, had a meeting this morning with a company that we work with. I don't know how much I'd say. Maybe 5 to 10 hours a week at the very, very most. And it's probably a lot less than that today. And most of the meetings I'm a part of are relatively short meetings. Every once in a while, I get stuck in one that's several hours and I can't take it. It feels to me like, you know, in the old days, going to temple or church, and I want to keep on walking out because I can't stand long meetings.
Certainly. Well, you wouldn't be the only one who can't stand long meetings. You know, after the pandemic, so many companies in many different industries are rethinking their meeting practices, and health systems are actually in that camp as well. So a couple of questions that I discussed with these HR leaders is how they're reevaluating the processes by which they hold meetings, and how exactly post-pandemic those things have changed. So a lot of different companies have said that 8 a.m. meetings or early morning meetings should be taken off the table, because in the more flexible work world, people tend to be sort of easing into their days. They might be taking kids to school. And so people are saying, you know, we should leave those mornings clear. So I talked to people leaders at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, at Mercy, at OSF Healthcare, UC Health, and WVU Medicine. And they all had sort of different views of whether or not this would be viable in healthcare, because we know that physicians have really wild schedules. They really require all of their waking hours to coordinate with and see patients. And also, healthcare is a 24-hour industry. So whereas a lot of other companies can say, you know, our workday is 8 to 5 and we're going to block off 8 to 10, no meeting zone, that's not as easy for health systems that might have to call emergency meetings for issues that happen throughout the day. However, at Mercy in St. Louis, Catherine Codispati, who is the system's senior vice president and chief people officer, told me that they have established meeting-free weekday mornings. So from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. across all 4 states that Mercy operates in, they are not scheduling meetings for clinical leaders or anybody else during those first 2 hours of sort of the waking, more corporate morning for most people. And the reason for this, she told me, is not just to reduce the number of meetings, but to encourage workers and managers to get out and have more meaningful one-on-one conversations with one another. So more to circle around, get a feel for the morning, and talk about the issues that are arising and actively need to be discussed. So sort of like you were saying, is a podcast, does that count as a meeting? Do just conversations count as a meeting? And in Mercy's view, no. This is just a time for scheduled meetings to be put to the side so that people can have face-to-face interactions with one another.
No, I think it's a fascinating discussion. And, you know, there's constantly this thing in the workplace about, and I've heard this subject for a very long time, about some organizations are over-meeting-centric, hold too long of meetings. Others are much better about it. In constantly trying to hit that right balance and, you know, making sure whoever's running meetings knows what they're actually trying to accomplish by having the meeting. And if the real purpose of the meeting is just for everybody to see each other's face and say hello, that might be a good reason to have a meeting to maintain that connection and chemistry. But then let's make sure it's a 10-minute meeting, not a 3-hour meeting. you know, I mean, there's a lot of different things that go around this. Does it have to be in person? Could it be remote? You know, especially in today's remote workplace where so many people are in different places. But how do you do this? And how do you sort of be very mindful that you want to make good use of everybody's time? I mean, the worst thing is a leader that doesn't really know why they're calling a meeting just because they've been doing it, and then makes that meeting last for hours, and everybody feels just more stressed because they can't get done the other things they need to get done. So I think that this discussion is an important discussion. It's an ongoing discussion, quite frankly, and fascinating.
Certainly, right. And like you said, a lot of health systems, even though they can't control exactly when meetings happen, at UC Health, their Chief Human Resources Officer, Dallas Howard Crow, told me that many providers prefer 6:30 a.m. meetings so they can spend the rest of the day with patients and then, you know, go home at night rather than being in meetings at the end of the day. But a lot of these health systems told me that one thing they're really putting in place is telling managers to send out agendas before each call and really trying to stick to those agendas, not let things get off track so that people can go and do what else they have to do during the day. They're also encouraging sending pre-read materials so people can read over any notes or documents on their own time ahead of the meeting. And then all of that is sort of taken care of when people sit down. They can just discuss. And they're all trying to whittle down meeting blocks from 1 hour to 45 minutes. Just because that gives people 15 minutes back at the end of the meeting block to take a restroom break, grab a snack, get some water. Whereas for some of these managers and upper level executives, without those 15 minute breaks built into their day, they could be in back-to-back meetings without any time to take care of those necessary things that we all need to do.
Completely. No, and I think this is just an ongoing issue. You know, it's so funny. People talk about 45-minute meetings. Again, I would think that most meetings could be constructive in 20 to 30 minutes and get done what has to get done. Depends what you're trying to do. If you're really trying to get everybody's different opinion and so forth and let them talk and let them hear each other and so forth, then it might take longer. But if you're really just trying to make sure everybody's on track with what has to be done, that might be a shorter status meeting. And it really just goes back to what you said, making sure we know what we're doing in each meeting. And I think that's really the point. And then tailoring it and being very mindful of time. People have so many different stresses, so many different things on their time, so many different demands on them. If you're not mindful of people's times, you just make their lives more and more difficult.
Certainly. And, you know, there is value in allowing employees to take some time for themselves, especially in those more sort of thought type administrative roles. So at OSF Healthcare, which is based in Peoria, their CHRO, Shelley Parn, told me that they're letting employees in many divisions set their own focus time. So if you have, you know, we use Google Suite. I know some places have Microsoft. But on those virtual calendars, you can add a focus time to your own slot. And then meetings can't be added on top of those blocks. So employees at OSF in certain divisions have the freedom to add focus time and say, hey, from 8 to 9 today, I'm working on this and don't schedule a meeting with me. I have this time blocked out for something of my own or a project I need to think through on my own. And managers are expected to respect that.
No, and I think that's fantastic. And I think it's you know, in the old days, you know, people would have to find ways to hide to do what they to get their best work done. Because there's certain periods of time, if you're a writer or a thinker or doing something, there are periods of the day where if you can hide, you could do much better concentration for better periods of time. And if in contrast, you're not allowed to have some of those blocks and focus times, it's just very hard to do it.
Certainly. And, you know, of course, in healthcare, there is so much value in people being able to huddle, talk face-to-face, work problems out. But at the same time, you know, there's so much administrative work that we all have to do. So I think that a lot of systems are seeing value in just being more intentional with the meetings that they do host.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Lexi, other issues that you're following currently, anything else that's top of mind?
Sure. So in terms of, you know, conversations with HR officers over the past week, something else I asked them about was this issue of imposters in healthcare. And that sounds a bit ominous, so I'll explain what I mean. So it's been a little over a year since the FBI and the Justice Department cracked open Operation Nightingale, which was that degree scheme that we all heard of where fake nursing degrees were sold out of three now shuttered nursing schools in Florida. And more than 7,600 fraudulent diplomas and transcripts were sold to nurses without them having to complete the necessary coursework to graduate. So we had some pretty underqualified people working in our healthcare system without knowing it. And although that was a really big case, it's not the only one. We've also seen stories of people posing as PAs, as NPs, as nurses, and even as physicians all in the past year. I covered a story last week where a former Iowa hospital administrator pled guilty to identity theft and had used forged documents to obtain the highest level of entry in the hospital's computer systems, and they had hired him under a different name than was actually his name. So we see all of these different stories, and obviously they tend to be really popular stories, big news stories. So we don't want to get into the trap of thinking that these are super common issues, but especially after Operation Nightingale, it raised some questions about the credentials of people in the healthcare space, with, you know, hospitals having access to medical records, having access to a lot of different drugs. You know, it is kind of a hot spot for people who might have poor intentions. So I spoke with HR leaders to see how concerned we need to be about this. And they sort of said, they were a mixed bag of opinions. A couple of them said that they are increasingly concerned about imposters or, quote, bad actors entering their healthcare system, especially with AI rising and the amount of technology that people have access to and just how savvy the population has become. It's a lot more easy for people to fabricate identities. So a lot of leaders said that they are going above and beyond their state's minimum hiring requirements and not only running state background checks, but federal background checks and really bolstering their hiring requirements to make sure that those are airtight and they do everything they can to ensure that nobody who shouldn't be caring for patients gets in and is.
No, fascinating, Lexi. So much of this going on. It's insane that there's these fraudulent degrees that let people become nurses that aren't really qualified to be nurses. I mean, the whole thing is really, like, you know, at the end of the day, it feels just insane that that's out there, but it is what it is, right?
Certainly, yes. And it's not the sort of thing that, you know, will happen in every hospital, that will happen in every town, but just something that HR professionals should be cognizant of moving forward is that these issues are out there, and the more in depth that your hiring process is, you know, if you have the ability to do lengthy employment checks, a lot of systems say they go back at least 3 years and make sure to speak to a manager or above at past employers. They want to ensure that they do universal background checks because sometimes a credentialing issue will show up on a person's license, you know, well after that issue was actually occurring just because of the backlogs in state licensure departments. So they're running pretty consistent checks on people's licenses just to make sure that nothing has come up since that person has been hired that might be an issue now. And so lots of different things that health systems are doing to, you know, make sure all their bases are covered and that their patients are in the best hands that they can be.
Fantastic. Lexi, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. It's always fantastic to visit with you. Always interesting issues. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.